O my Lord, Sri Krishna, son of Vasudeva, O all-pervading personality of Godhead, I offer my respectful obeisances unto you. I meditate upon Lord Krishna because he is the absolute truth and is the primeval cause of all causes of the creation, sustenance, and destruction of the manifested universe. He is directly and indirectly conscious of all manifestations, and he is independent because there is no other cause beyond him. It is he only who first imparted Vedic knowledge into the heart of Brahmaji, the original living being. By him, even the great sages and demigods are placed into illusion. As one is bewildered by the illusory representation of water seen in fire or land seen in water. Only because of him do the material universes, temporarily manifested by the reactions of the three modes of nature, appear factual, although they are unreal. I therefore meditate upon him, Lord Sri Krishna, who is eternally existent in the transcendental abode, which is forever free from the illusory representations of the material world. I meditate upon him, for he is the absolute truth. Purport. Obeisances unto the personality of Godhead, Vasudeva, directly indicate Lord Sri Krishna, who is the divine son of Vasudeva and Devaki. This fact will be more explicitly explained in the text of this work. Sri Vyasadeva asserts herein that Sri Krishna is the original personality of Godhead, and all others are his direct or indirect plenary portions, or portions of the portion. Srila Jiva Goswami has even more explicitly explained the subject matter in his Krishna Sandarbha. And Brahma, the original living being, has explained the subject of Sri Krishna substantially in his treatise named Brahma Samhita. In the Samaveda Upanishad, it is also stated that Lord Sri Krishna is the divine son of Devaki. Therefore, in this prayer, the first proposition holds that Lord Sri Krishna is the primeval Lord. And if any transcendental nomenclature is to be understood, indicated by the word Krishna, which means the all-attractive. In Bhagavad Gita, in many places, the Lord asserts himself to be the original personality of Godhead. And this is confirmed by Arjuna, also by great sages like Narada, Vyasa, and many others. In the Padma Purana, it is also stated that out of the innumerable names of the Lord, the name of Krishna is the principal one. Vasudeva indicates the plenary portion of the personality of Godhead, and all the different forms of the Lord being identical with Vasudeva are indicated in this text. The name Vasudeva particularly indicates the divine son of Vasudeva and Devaki. Sri Krishna is always meditated upon by the Paramahamsas, who are the perfected ones among those in the renounced order of life. So then this is the opening of the Srimad Bhagavatam, the very beginning. And so in here, then we get what is the essence or what's being described within the literature. The opening statement then has to explain what the work will contain. And so we see that here Vyasadeva has done the opening statement then in the first three verses. So this is the first of the three. So this describes the sambandha, the relationships of the tattva and activities of Krishna. So in here then, first is then he has to establish that Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. He's transcendental. He is not ordinary like anyone else. Then we see from there he comes down from being transcendental into that he has expanded into everything. It means all other manifestations in the cosmic creation, they are him. They're not somebody else. So he is expanded as everything. Then from there, then we get the demigods. Or Brahmaji, and then the other demigods, and they're all kept in illusion by Krishna. Because of their desire to be separate or enjoy, they're in this illusion, and that's coming from Krishna. Then we see that he then establishes then this material world is functioning by the modes of nature, therefore it's illusory. Means the material existence is there, but our value that we put on it is illusory. This is an important part, I mean important understanding. The impersonalist will take it that the material world is illusory, means it does not exist at all. It's just a figment of our imagination. Interesting is that who is in charge that makes everybody have exactly the same figment, that it's all there. You know, you point out a tree, everyone sees the tree. So it's pretty well arranged. So then, but we take it to its actual position where the material world exists, but the value we place on it, that is what's illusory. Right? Means gold exists, but that we say it's a value and it's important for our happiness and satisfaction. That we can gain happiness from it, that's illusion. Because no one has. So many people have money, they've never been happy. People haven't had money, they're also not happy. And there are those who don't care if they have or don't have, they're happy, whether they have money or don't have. Sudama Vipra was happy when he had nothing, and he was happy when he had so much opulence, greater than Indra's. But we see Indra, he's not happy. Right? He has that opulence, he's not happy. He's missing something, he's not satisfied. So then it comes down that it's our, we put these illusions, we overlay them. This is called aropya. We apply this on the material energy. And because this is our habit, then we see we will do the same thing when it comes to the spiritual. Means we will take the material energy, which is dead matter, has no value, has no connection with us. We will overlay on it that this is something very nice that I can be happy with. So then when we take up devotional service, the tendency is to do exactly the same thing. Is that I what I like of the material world, then I'll overlay that onto devotional service. So that's just our habit. So that's not a problem. But it's just eventually then this idea that the material energy is a value has to be given up at some point. Right? So either that's given up by the attachment to Krishna is so great, and then it's dropped, or we just by analyzation and sadhana understand that it's not worthwhile and we drop it and then turn our attention to something worthwhile, which is developing that attachment to Krishna. So either way can be used. Either directly attach yourself to Krishna or do that after detaching oneself. It means either one will work. Or, as we generally see, is we use a combination. Sadhana bhakti means it's a combination. We perform those activities that will attract us to Krishna. At the same time as we perform activities and have an understanding that there's nothing to gain here. Right? So then with time we figure, okay, I have to gain from somewhere. So then of things to gain, Krishna is the best. And so then I will put my attention there. So then we are able to give up the material nature and attach yourself to Krishna. So then that is then established. So we see from Krishna all the way down to the material energy. So Krishna is described. Then it goes back again to the spiritual world. So in this verse, it gives a nutshell of the whole thing. A nutshell of the whole thing. So then in that, then we see, of all the three verses, that we see Krishna, he is the original Supreme Personality of Godhead. So everything comes from him. So he is the origin of everything, right? So that's the first point with Krishna that must be established. Second, then with this, we see is that he has his spiritual realm, right? And he's the cause of all causes. Then it's hidden there, so it will be brought out in the next verses, that he is being the source of everything. That means if the material world, if there is illusory, it's illusory because we think there's some rasa here. And that's come from him. That means there is original rasa. Right? There's original taste is there. So from that, then he is the reservoir of all rasa. Then we see is that He being the highest truth, everything's expanded from Him. So if you understand these three, you understand Godhead. He's the supreme cause of all causes. He is the origin of all energies, and He is the origin or the ocean of rasa. If you understand these three, you understand Godhead. So that is brought out, that is, means those, the sambandha aspects are brought out more clearly here, and the others will be brought out in the next two verses. Then he gets into the material energy. You have to understand the material energy. And he's getting into the nature, the consciousness of the living entity, that they become attracted or attached to the material energy. And this is their fallen position. Right? So here then the Bhadajis are then described, that they are attached to this material world, and they are put into illusion. So we will see in the next verses, then we will hear about the fortunate persons, the method that they're going to use to get out of it, and those, the Paramahamsas, as Prabhupada mentioned here, that this is meant for the Paramahamsas. Right? Krishna is always meditated on by the Paramahamsas. So, and that he is simultaneously aware and not aware. So this is the Achinta Veda Veda Tattva, that, and also the different aspects of Krishna's mood, that he is Sarvajna, that he is aware of everything, same time he's Mudgata, he is absorbed in his pastime. So it's not a... For him, both of these are realities. So then, and that we meditate upon him, like that, I offer my obeisances, the devotional process, and that he is the goal. But we see the emphasis of all these points is emphasizing, you know, Krishna as the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and that the material energy is under his control. Like that. So this is what's mainly emphasized. Then in other verses, the nature of the living entity, the nature of the devotional process, and the ultimate goal, those will be drawn out. So the first thing to be established then is that Krishna is the Supreme Absolute Truth. If that is established and is accepted, then the whole philosophy and the whole Bhagavatam has meaning. If that's not accepted, then there's a problem. There'll always be a problem. Because if it's a problem, then how will accept his pastimes, all the different things he does, all the different aspects that are there in the relationship between him and the devotees? That we can't. So the Bhagavatam, this has to be the first point established. You accept that Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead, then the book is worth reading. And then, if you accept that, that you accept that there is a pure standard to worship him, right? And that the ultimate goal is that pure love for him. So those who are interested only in that aspect, then it becomes worthwhile. Otherwise, not so worthwhile. It doesn't have any real meaning then. That's the difficulty. So it has to open with this. Does that make some sense? Why the Bhagavatam is opening this way? Because of all the points that must be made in the philosophy, the first one to be made is that he is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. That's the first one that must be established. If that's accepted, then all the others that, okay, then being the Supreme Lord, then that means all energies and all rasa come from him. If that happens, then it all works. And if it doesn't happen, then it doesn't work. This is why it has to open this way. And then Vyasadeva so expertly then worked all these together into this nice combination. Any questions on... This is the first paragraph out of, I think, 16 or something like that.
Huh? 9 and 10.
We actually read it through first.
Oh, okay. You've already... Oh, so you're on 9 and 10. Oh. Mine just happens to be... Three.
We only read the first two paragraphs.
Yeah. If you could read the third paragraph, we read the two first ones.
You read the two first ones. Okay, so not about the third one. So 9 and 10 is...
Well, that's what they say.
I'm just talking about the Three. It is natural that a philosophical mind wants to know about the origin of the creation. At night he sees the stars in the sky and he naturally speculates about their inhabitants. Such inquiries are natural for man because man has a developed consciousness which is higher than that of the animals. The author of Srimad Bhagavatam gives a direct answer to such inquiries. He says that the Lord Sri Krishna is the origin of all creations. He is not only the creator of the universe, but the destroyer as well. The manifested cosmic nature is created at a certain period by the will of the Lord. It is maintained for some time, and then it is annihilated by His will. Therefore, the supreme will is beyond all cosmic activities. Of course, there are atheists of various categories who do not believe in a creator, but that is due to a poor fund of knowledge. The modern scientist, for example, has created space satellites, and by some arrangement or other, these satellites are thrown into outer space to fly for some time at the control of the scientist who is far away. Similarly, all the universes with innumerable stars and planets are controlled by the intelligence of the personality of Godhead. So Prabhupada is making the point that someone who is philosophical, who is thoughtful, wants to know. They want to know what is going on. Because they will see so many things and it's inquisitive. Even if they're not so philosophical, see little children, they're always inquiring about everything. They want to know why this is that, why that was that, why this man did this, and why the tree is that. And they just go on and on. So this is natural. If one has intelligence, one naturally wants to know. So then the point comes is that is there because human life is meant for a higher purpose, and then that higher purpose is fulfilled if you accept this point that Krishna is the Lord. Then that means then whatever's here, He has created. He is the source of it. So that means He's the source of all energy. So when that is understood, then you can move forward. Problem is the scientists don't accept this. They all say, no, there can't be a creator. But all they are doing is creating. Right? Scientist means you create. If you don't create, what is the meaning of being a scientist? Right? If you don't create some theory, some equation, some chemical reaction, some mechanical thing, then what's the meaning? It doesn't mean anything. It doesn't have any meaning being a scientist. So all they're doing is creating. The problem is their ego is so large that they don't find any space in the universe for God, right? Because their ego has already filled it up. So there's no, you can't stick any other thing in there, right? It means others who are submissive to them, they can accommodate, but if not, they can't, right? Though they're supposed to be right. Science is supposed to be very objective, open-minded, you know, broad, and all these things, and not like these closed-minded, sentimental, you know, religionists. But we see that, like when our devotees put out that, what is it, forbidden archaeology? That is taking just the evidence, scientific evidence, and what might be conclusions you can get from it. Right? It means we have all this evidence, it points in a certain direction, right? We have all these different evidences, and by that, then we have to come to a conclusion that modern man has always existed. And that this idea of evolution is not there, that we have all these different things at once. And so then, those in the field who are the most renowned for their work on, you know, digging in piles of dust and filling out pieces of bones and, you know, one tooth and reconstructing a whole body and, you know, what he's wearing, what brand he was wearing, you know, what he would wear on Sunday, what he'd wear out to the movies, all these different things. So then we see is that they didn't take very kindly to this arrangement by the devotees or this conclusion. They were just saying it's a bunch of nonsense. It's you know, just they try to write it off. Though these are factual facts that are there in all the archaeological, you know, what do you call it? They keep them, what do you call it? Archives, yeah. It's all there. I mean, that's where we got it from. It's all in their books. It's all there in little bottles and on shelves and all that. You can go look at it. So they're just going mad. But so then we see mind is not open. It's very closed. Right? Generally, you'll find those who say about this, you know, the scientists are broad-minded like this, then they're not very broad-minded. You know, they're very limited. Broad meaning that they don't accept what others are doing, the common sentimental people, you know. They are something different. So to make themselves special, then they profess these things. Because if they don't profess something different, what's the meaning? Muni means you must be different. So they profess these, but they don't themselves are able to see anything beyond that, because they don't have the intelligence. It means they have intelligence, but their mind, we always have to remember, is that the intelligence simply discerns. So scientists and these very intellectual people have great ability to discern between two different objects, or to find a commonality between two objects that seemingly don't have any. You know, it's just like, okay, what's the connection between this wall and that tree out there? Right? Means, you know, you generally say, well, there's no difference. I mean, there's no commonality. You could take the color, they're both green, like that, or they're both vertical. You know, you can always find something. Or you can say there's a difference. You know, this is a wall, and like that is inorganic, that's organic. You know, or that's growing in a natural way, this is very straight, or this is hard, that's soft, this won't burn, that'll burn. So you can always, so that's intelligence, just to find the differences, or to find what's a similarity. So they're very expert at that. Problem is then they have to go back to their mind to come to the conclusion. Because the mind makes the conclusion, not the intelligence. Intelligence doesn't make the conclusion. Intelligence will point out what could be, but the mind has to accept it. So then that's the difficulty, is that their mind is already prejudiced, that it can't be any, it couldn't be God, right? Even if they were looking in their ion microscope at the atom and they get down there and then he goes, Fred, this is little guy there with four arms. You know, I mean, he's waving at me.
Harry, I think you need a little rest, you know, you need a little rest.
They couldn't accept. They wouldn't be able to deal with it. It means that it is a personal, that there's a person, they couldn't handle it. They wouldn't be able to handle it. So that's their thing, is that it's got to be something inorganic, just some chemicals and all this and that. And we see is that they're very emotional about this. Right? Though they're claiming to be, they're very emotional about these things. So the mind is ultimately what you have to deal with. So that's the whole point here, is that ultimately that's what you're going to have to deal with. It's your mind. These other things, your intelligence is important. It'll help get you out of the material world. But it's the mind. When the mind accepts Krishna, then you move forward. If the mind doesn't accept Krishna, then you don't move forward. So that's the main thing, is to get the mind to accept the Lord. If that's done, then it becomes good. And if it doesn't, then it doesn't get anywhere. So then the intelligence must come to that conclusion. Okay. So then that basically... Any questions on this? Yes.
So... all the living entities in the universe or in this world, it seems that when their mind doesn't accept Krishna or Creator, there's no amount of logic that will even persuade them.
No, because the reason logic won't persuade them is because you're going up against the mind.
But does that mean that they have always been atheists? Is there a point?
Yeah, there's always atheists. I mean, otherwise, how do people stay here for so long? Right? Does that make sense? Is that they stay here because of that principle, of the atheistic principle. Because the atheistic principle creates sense gratification. Because if I am the controller, then I'm the enjoyer. Right? And there's no... what are you going to do with it? You're in control, but what are you going to do with it? You have to enjoy it in some way. You know? Like that. There has to be something that you're getting out of it. Even if you don't directly, just the indirect, that others are impressed with your ability of control. But you control it because there's something you want to gain from it. So that's the point, is impersonalism creates sense gratification. as Sri Prabhupada says, it's just the two go together. You know? So you see, as this whole upsurge in impersonalism in the world, then that just creates sense gratification. Because there's no God, so it doesn't matter, and then so that puts us in control. Somebody's got to run the place, so we do it, and then it's all here, so why we shouldn't be enjoying it? So it immediately comes. So you'll find is that generally the more someone's into sense gratification, the more atheistic they are. Or at least the less God-conscious. And the more God-conscious they are, then generally the more they are in control of the senses. Like that. In this modern scenario. Before, because there was the aspect of prestige, they would enjoy the subtle sense gratification by being renounced. Right. By being renounced, then they would definitely establish that they're, you know, God and like this kind of that in their own mind. But nowadays the so it's more on intelligence and they would just attach the principle on God. So that would be the stumbling block. But the modern is then you throw into this impersonalism all the sentiments and emotions and so-called seeming relations and all that. And so you get this modern kind of impersonal philosophy, which is its bottom line is sex. You know? That's the bottom line. You know, anything that's wrong, you're going to have psychiatrist. Anything that's wrong is you restricting yourself. If you're a devotee, they ask what you're doing. Immediately, that's the first thing they'll say, because you're restricting yourself. You can guarantee. You don't even have to bother going. You know, it's just, that's what they're going to tell you, no, because you're restricting yourself, you're creating all these things, you just let yourself go, and this and that. It says, just let yourself go, yes, yes, do whatever you want, yes, yes. So, if I pull out this Uzi out of my handbag and blow you away, then that will be, you know, you'll feel that I'm moving in the right direction, right? You know? And, but most likely they won't agree at that point, you know, because then you won't be able to appreciate the $300 you got to pay them after this session. So, like that, it's something's being. It's just where they're going to go. It's where they take it. And you take anything. What is it? It's going in that direction. Any of this philosophies, New Age. It's all going in that direction, like that. So that's the difficulty with the impersonal. So they have to do that, because if you put a God there, that means that he's in control, so that means he's the enjoyer. So I can only enjoy things the way he says I can. Right? If I just walk into a big mansion that's all outfitted and everything's there, and I say nobody owns this place, it's just here for the taking, then I can do what I want in the house. Right? But if I recognize that this belongs to somebody, and you can look around and see it's well organized and clean and all that. So that means I have to be careful how I deal in the house. So the point is the unrestricted mind doesn't want to be controlled. So therefore, then impersonalism becomes the very, you know, easy way of for enjoyment. Does that make some sense? Where's the balance? The control means if one follows the process, then the desire to control will fade away. But what is there is the bridge between the two is, if the controlling propensity is there, then you have to see what is it you want to control. And then control it for Krishna, for his pleasure, how he wants it controlled. Right? So then that means it engages your conditioned nature to control in his service. By that, then you can remove it. You don't by ignoring it, because one will control anyway. That's what Krishna told Arjuna. He says, you're a Kshatriya. You're going to fight. So even if you get up here, walk off your chariot, walk straight out into the forest, we never see you again. You know, rumors have come back about all the fights and this and that go on in the forest started by you. Because you're Kshatriya. You're going to do that. You know, some demon comes along, you're going to kill it. You know. So somebody comes along who's not properly behaved, you're going to fight with them. It's just going to happen.
Arogya.
And that you'll, if one analyzes, one sees a lot of difficulties comes from that. Is that so many, difficulties over position, over facility, whatever it may be, is based on this. Is that one will have the tendency to want to do things the way you want, without considering others. So then the etiquette then starts to bring that in mind. You have to consider. You have to see what's the bigger picture, how you fit into the bigger picture, how they fit into the bigger picture. Therefore, what's your relationship in the bigger picture, rather than what's the relationship as I perceive it or as they perceive it. So one has to be very careful, because there is a difference between where I just overlay my desires onto devotional service and go about trying to get them, and the goal is for me. And I see that I have these propensities to deal, on the conditioned platform, so let me engage those in Krishna service like that. So both of them are the same. You're still overlaying, but the goal is different. One is you're doing it because you want to fulfill your desire. The other is you have a need, but you don't want to fulfill it separately than pleasing Krishna. Right? So its origin may be the same, but how you will apply it will be different, because you're seeing a bigger picture. It means one is the sambandha. You see yourself and the object and the goal that you can get out of it and the method you're going to get that with. The other is that you see the same thing. You have that desire, so you have to fulfill that, but then you see is that you're going to deal with it how Krishna wants, and the goal is actually for Krishna. Though you have the nature, you have to get that kind of goal. You might probably tell us the story of the thief. He had to steal, but he was now a devotee, so he couldn't steal, so he would just go and sneak things out of one person's bag and stick them in another person's bag, and then sneak something out of there and put it in the next bag. So that way then he fulfilled his need to be able to, in a secretive way, get something of value out of one person's bag into his hand. But then, because he didn't want to get lost, so he would put in another person's bag and then take stuff out of there, and like this. And you all know this story? Okay, so then this thief had become a devotee, and then these devotees said, ask him, invite him to come on them a pilgrimage. So they were traveling, going to Vrindavan. So on the way, then he couldn't contain himself anymore. He was a thief. So he started doing this. He would do that at night, right? They go out at night, steal things. So in the morning, then when the people got up and the devotees got up, started to look through their bags to get their stuff, something's missing. And they see someone else pull it out of their bag, right? And they say, hey, what's this? And then, hey, that's mine. And then started the whole thing. You took my this, that. This big riot was going on. And finally at the end, and the thief said, no, it's all my fault. Says, because I'm a thief, but I'm a devotee now, so I can't steal. So to satisfy that need, I just took everything out of each other's bag and put it in there. So actually, it was me. So, like that, is that the desire is there, but one wants to please Krishna by it. The other is the desire is there, and one only sees one's own need. One doesn't see Krishna and how that desire fits into the bigger picture of Krishna's service and whatever is the sphere you're working in, okay? It's just, I see mine, what I want, but then there's something bigger. There's the temple program, and there's the temple, there's the devotees, there's the community, there's the world community, there's the mission. And then we see, where does that fit in there? Like that famous one where Prabhupada, started off, how about, this unlimited universes, right? But out of these unlimited universes, then the smallest of the universes is there. Then within this huge universe with all these covers, then there's 14 the planetary systems. Within these 14 planetary systems, there's the Earth with its 7 mandalas. Of the 7, there's 1 mandala. Of that, then we're on the southern side of Meru. And in that, then there's, you know, so many countries. Then there's India. In India, then there's Bengal. In Bengal, then there's, you know, Nadia. In Nadia, then we have Mayapur. In Mayapur, then there's the Lotus Building. In the Lotus Building, then you have the second floor. In the second floor, then there's Prabhupada's room. And in Prabhupada's room, then there's somebody sitting there who thinks he's the Lord of the whole cosmic creation. Like that. So Prabhupada is pointing that out to how the devotee can fall into this mentality of forgetting their service even in relationship to Krishna. So it's nice, Krishna is accepting, but the thing is because it's actually Krishna's control, it's a whole different scene, then that aspect has to be balanced. That's the thing, it needs to be balanced. So then one has to be able to see a bigger picture and see what is there, you know? It means we have to get something done. Why do we have to get anything done? Why is it important? Okay, I manage the universe. Okay, why? You know, it's because it needs to be managed. Well, who said it needs to be managed? Right? I mean, it's like that. So Lord Chaitanya said, Rupa Goswami said, it's come down to the Acharyas. Then Prabhupada's given us things to manage, right? And how to manage them, like that. And then within that big sphere, then there's so many, right? We have so many temples. We have so many this and that. So then you start to see what is our position in the bigger picture. Otherwise, the tendency is whatever we're doing, that becomes the all in all. Like that, it's natural. Like that. So then, because we get a taste out of it, right? And knowledge-wise, we can say yes. But taste-wise, then that becomes prominent for us. That's why, that's where Maya comes, right? Is into that area, is that because of the taste, we forget the knowledge. You know, this point, you know, Prabhu is pointing out is that the most intelligent person you can explain to them, but because of their taste, they can't understand it, even though they have the intelligence to understand it. Prabhu would always find great pleasure in talking to these great Sanskrit pundits, asking, you know, who is the Supreme? You know, what is the Supreme, or who is the Supreme? Oh, very difficult, Swamiji, you know, so many this, that. And after they fail, then he would call over an 8-year-old kid, you know, from the Gurukul, and then say, who's the Supreme Personality God? Hey, Krishna, like that. You know? So it says, even the 8-year-old can understand it. How come you can't understand it? So it's blocked by their desire, the taste that they're getting from whatever is their sphere that they're dealing with, so then you can't relate to the rest of it. So that's why then if one can reduce the material taste and try to transfer that to the spiritual, then it becomes quicker. So the more that's transferred, the quicker the progress. And the more it's rooted here, then at least if one can use the intelligence to at least go about getting that taste through proper means, devotional means, then that taste will be purified and engaged in Krishna's service. So it, even though you're putting it onto the material energy, because you're doing that for Krishna, it becomes Krishnaized. So then indirectly you put your taste onto Krishna. You know? Like that. So then that's what we'll do. That makes sense.
Something else? Maharaj, you mentioned that Chincha Veda Abheda Kappa. I didn't quite catch that point. Where is it in the verse? Maybe it's one to the
means he is directly and indirectly conscious of all manifestations. Yeah. Means it's not fully brought out there, but it's just he can be both at once. That's a contradictory to say that he is conscious of all manifestation at the same time not. Right? Like that. And directly meaning he is as Krishna is. Right? But at the same time, he's indirectly, you know, that Balaram, he's the one who's there. And Balaram is directly, but he's indirectly because Mahanarayan is. And he's directly, he's indirectly through Sankarshan. And he's directly, indirectly, because then you have Karana Dakshaya Vishnu, and then down the expanses of Garva Dakshaya, Kira Dakshaya. Like that. So Krishna is simultaneously conscious of the whole thing, at the same time as he steps back, takes part in his Leela, and leaves it up to Balaram. You know, because he is Balaram, at the same time he's not. You know, that's the subtlety of the whole thing. Is that for rasa there's difference. Tattva, then you can make the discernation, but at the same time is they're him. You know, that's, you know, probably gives the example of the high court judge at home with his family, and then at the office. You know, he's sitting on the bench. He dresses differently, talks differently, associates are different. The whole purpose and everything he does is different. So you could come to the mistake saying it's a different person, like that. The difference here then is in the material world, then that is all done by the same body. You just change the costume and the place. But Krishna, in doing that, changes his form to match it also. And we can only do one at a time. Well, he can do both at a time. So he can sit down at the bench 24 hours a day, and he can sit at home 24 hours a day. So he can do both. Like that. So Prabhupada would say it's like Vaikuntha, it's like, you know, Krishna at the office. Right? So then he's very formal there. Does that make sense? So in other words, it's the first verse, so the first verse has to have the seed for the whole thing. At the same time as Vyasadeva is giving what has to be delineated in the opening statements over the three verses. Like that. So therefore he doesn't have to say the details of everything in the first verse. It becomes expanded into the second and third. So that seems to be something specifically. Many writers do it, but not many do it. It seems to be specifically in our line, the Vaishnava line, especially Gaudiya line, where they expand the opening statement, you know, almost into a whole introduction, like that. You know, it's like that. But others tend to just stick to the rules and just do it in one verse. Like that. So then, but the seed, you may miss the real meaning. So here it's expanded to the point where it's very clear that this is going to be. Does that make sense? Impersonal philosophy presented as personal. You're talking about traditional or modern? Both. Both, okay. In your traditional, then you'd have, we take that as modern. Traditional would be, is that they're talking about the individual souls. And you're individual, and for your benefit, then you should make this endeavor and detach yourself and take sannyas and study the Vedanta, these kind of things. But at the same time, then their point is that we're all one. But if we're all one, then if one is liberated, why do the others have to bother? You know what I'm saying? That's the point. So it's not well thought out. So they still can't get away from the point of being an individual like that. Otherwise, why does the individual have to do it? You know, like that. Because it doesn't matter if it's all one. It doesn't matter if all the parts have to get back together. Because if you can separate it, means that it's two. Right? It's just like water. You have water in the pot. You know, you can put your hand in and move to this side, that side. It's still the same water. You can't separate it. Right? But if you can take it out and put it in another place, then you can separate it. You know, you can say, but when you pour it back, it'll merge. No, you can take it out again. Right? That's how Madhvacharya defeated, at the time, I think, one of the greatest impersonalists. That this impersonalist had read his philosophy after he met Vyasadeva and made his commentary in Vedanta Sutta. He read it, and he was highly impressed because he was a, you know, actual seeker of the truth. And he was super intelligent. So he read the commentary, and then he came to see him. And he says, I've read it, everything makes sense, but the one point, he gave that example, is that you take the water out, and I can understand it separately, you can pour it back, and it becomes merged again. So then Madhvacharya just told his servant to bring bring his gindi and his akshman cup, you know, the things that he uses to put on tila. He took everything out, and he had a tray. Then he had the akshman cup, then he had the pot, you know, the snail in it. He poured them both into the tray. You know? And, you know, that was what he's talking about, the two merge. And then the guy's looking. And then he took the thing, he took the tray, picked it up, poured what was originally in the actual cup back in the actual cup, meaning what was in the gindi back in the gindi. And then he understood. So there was no speaking. He answered this question without even speaking, and the guy just surrendered on the spot. Like that. So there, but it still is the personal is underneath, you know, like that. The jaimini, that's impersonal, means that means the living entities are personal, your enjoyment is personal. But the idea that there's a supreme lord and that he's in control is not there. Right? That's why it's meant. Is you can defeat all the other philosophies with jaimini. But he doesn't accept that God's in control. Therefore it's said here, God's in control. You know, from outside the universe to inside. Then he's in control. So then we defeat jaimini. Then you have to get into, then he's the supreme person. Then you defeat the impersonalism. You know, they're also, like what you were saying, these are modern religions. They all say God's a person and this and that. But if you get down to it, and you really get into it, except for a couple of theologians, it all goes down to the impersonal platform. Like that. That's just where it is. When it gets right down to the bottom, he has no form, he has no shape, he has no... like that. So that would be another. Then this New Age stuff, that's all the personalism. They talk relationship, you know, very nice and careful and this and that, but it's always just one way. Relationship's always two-way. You know, the person that's the victim, he has the right to annoy everyone and disturb everybody's life. You know, it's his right because he's been dissatisfied in some way, you know. But still, it's one way, you know. So you're saying he's the victim because it was one way relationship, that means exploitation. So now he can do it one way or the other way, and then somehow know that that's supposed to be nice. No, he's supposed to bring it where both deal with each other in the proper way. So that's also impersonal. You know, we discussed the scientists and impersonals. Like that. So basically, you'll see basically everything if you get down to it's impersonal. Though it may have some covering of personalism. So, because people generally aren't that thoughtful, you can many times get them beyond that, because they haven't even thought about the impersonalness of it. Right? If you say New Age, people say, no, it's very personal. If you say, you know, these world religions, they'll say, no, very personal. You know, it's personal God, or, you know, like this. But, no. I mean, as it is, you take many say Jesus and God are the same. You know, that wasn't how it's been going over the last 2,000 years. You know, it's, you know, you have Father, you have Son, and Holy Ghost. Now they just make them all one. Yeah, okay, Lutherans. So then, that was the thing. The Lutherans means they tried to reform the church. So what they reform it with, impersonalism. What they do? One, you throw out the Pope. You know, so you're your own man. Two, they throw out all music, all art, all decorations, all architecture, anything fine. And you just get down to austerity. Okay, so who throws out culture? Gets, and they're the center, they're their own guru, and they use renunciation, you know, for taking. What group of people do that in the Vedic system? Yeah, the Mayavadis, the impersonalists. So they've just used that system. Okay. They weren't able to reform, so they throw it out. So that's common. It's the West. It's the material disease, but especially the Western culture is very expert at that because everybody makes their own rules. You know, it's here. Okay, you can say the Pope made the rules. Okay, and then but then that's just thrown out. It's not like okay, these rules are there. Therefore, why don't people follow those rules? Right? You go back. The founder of their thought, right, their school, was trying to reform Judaism, not throw out Judaism. Right? He was simply saying that they had become smarter, so reform themselves. Right? Follow what God says. don't get so caught up in the rules, but understand the mood of it, this fact, then they didn't appreciate it. Because that means you have to bring yourself in line with it. No, it's your interpretation, right? Socrates had the same difficulty. He said there's an absolute truth, you have to bring your life in line with that. And the sophists and, you know, the Stoics and all, they didn't appreciate that. So then he had to be removed. Like that. So this is, it's a constant battle here, because there is no, means he was the first philosopher, right, in Western thought, Socrates. But Socrates wasn't merged into the church, right? Aristotle was, right? And Aristotle didn't have this concept, right? Isn't it? So that's the thing. So therefore it's based on that there supposedly there is an absolute, but nobody follows it, right? God gave the Ten Commandments and follow it. No, that's something you don't follow. That's fanatic. I can take the other guy's stuff as long as they don't take my stuff. Right? It's a difficulty in that the Vedic is that there's a standard. So therefore, if there is some discussion, then it's on the scriptures. So the scriptures cannot be doubted. Those who follow the Vedic literature, then you can argue over your interpretation or understanding of a verse of Gita, but that Gita is the authority, that can never be done. So that's the problem at the beginning of the Gita, says that at least theoretically accept, just in theory, you want to understand the book, just in theory understand that Krishna is God, devotional service is the process to please Him. You know that we're eternal, this, that. These few points, just accept them. Theoretically, read the book from that angle of vision, then you'll understand what the Gita is trying to say. Otherwise, if you don't, you'll never understand. And so by accepting like that, then we're able to see, even as temporarily, then one becomes impressed, and then one changes. It's like we'll say, they don't understand the philosophy, no interest, don't like the devotee, at least take the shot. And then from taking the shot, they're purified, and then they'll start to appreciate it. Does that make any sense? Anything else? Vrataraj Srimad Bhagavatam, Srila Prabhupada, Samadhi Ka, Bhaktivinoda, Srila Gopura.